This is What's It Like with Dr. Ken Tangen.
Hi, I'm Ken Tangen. This is episode 89 of What's It Like. My guest is Dan Miller. Somewhere in Tennessee?
Yes, sir.
Where are you located?
Oh, I am in Franklin, Tennessee.
Franklin.
Which is about 20 miles south of Nashville.
Oh.
So we when we're traveling, we tell people Nashville because they recognize that, but we're actually a little south, down where a lot of musicians hang out.
Well, yeah, that's a pretty area.
It is indeed. We love it here.
Did you grow up in that area?
No, we've been here, though, for about 30 years, but grew up in a rural farm in Ohio, milking cows, and I figured there'd have to be something better than getting up at 5 o'clock to milk cows in 0-degree temperature and throwing hay bales in the summer. So when I got married, Joanne and I kept moving a little further south, went to Kentucky, and then came on down to Tennessee again about 30 years ago and love it here.
Did you come from a large family?
There were 5 children. I came from a Mennonite farm family, and in the Mennonite tradition, a lot of times there are large families, so we were kind of medium in that regard, but had 5 children, grew up on a farm. My dad was bivocational. He pastored a little tiny church and then was a farmer to make a living.
Mm. I talked to Anthony Stoffer, who's a guitarist and grew up Mennonite, and he says there's several levels of Mennoniteness.
That's an interesting way to frame it. That's certainly true. Some are very conservative, very legalistic, and others you'd meet them on the street or in a restaurant and never know that they were Mennonite at all.
Mm-hmm. So when you were growing up, who had the biggest influence on your life?
You know, that's an interesting question because the biggest influence on my life was, in essence, virtual. I knew that there were better opportunities than what I was seeing there. And somehow, when I was about 12 years old, I got a hold of the little Earl Nightingale audio recording, The Strangest Secret. And here's this gravelly-voiced old guy talking about we become what we think about. And I thought, you know, do I really have that option as a poor farm kid? Could I really go more, see more, be more than what I am looking at right here if I just change what I think about? So I became a student through the library, through books and audio recordings, and it was those people. So it was people like Norman Vincent Peale and Robert Schuller and Earl Nightingale, Napoleon Hill, all those old masters of success that really became my mentors.
Mm-hmm.
I had none of that in my physical surroundings, none whatsoever, and was actually isolated and attempted to be protected from that. But that was my escape. And rather than just going into self-destructive kind of things, I was drawn like a magnet to things that were actually self-improvement. And so that became my ticket out of that environment, my ticket to a better future, and that is exactly the way that it's played out. Those themes in those old motivational series, you know, became my mantras. So, you know, I know about stinking thinking and doing a checkup from the neck up and positive mental attitude and all the principles that we hear from those guys. And those, so that's really heavily shaped my life. And it's interesting, with my 4 siblings, they've all chosen very different lives than I have. I love them dearly, but we have very different lives today as a result of that. They chose to continue pretty much in that same kind of environment, same kind of mentality. And again, I don't fault them for that, but the world was opened up to me as a result of listening to some wonderful, wonderful motivational material. So I'm a big believer in that.
What was your major challenge as a child?
I guess it was overcoming, you know, what were perceived obstacles. There was no encouragement to go to college, and yet I thought that was going to be a useful part of expanding my opportunities. So I went without my parents' approval, with their disapproval, actually. When I turned 16, my dad thought that I owed it to him to then help in the farm. That was kind of the trade-off. He kept a roof over my head and fed me when I was a kid. Now it was my opportunity to pay him back by working on the farm. So I did that. Didn't have the guts at that point to say no to that. So I did that. But then I started sneaking in college classes at night. So I would get up at 5:30, milk those Holstein cows, work all day in the fields, and then at night from 6 to 10 o'clock, I started taking extension courses through the Ohio State University and started accumulating credits toward my eventual degree. Now, what happened in there really is that because I was burning the candle at both ends, literally, I got sick and couldn't recover. I got a severe case of mononucleosis and could not recover. And finally realized I was going to have to make some tough decisions. I could no longer expect to put in the kind of hours I was doing on the farm and go to school and date the beautiful young lady that was going to become my wife. So there came a parting of the ways. I had to share the news with my dad that I could not do both and that I was choosing to go on to college. So that was a painful time. Now, I'll be quick to add that time is a wonderful healer. And in the ensuing years, you know, those feelings softened, and my dad was extremely proud of things I've been able to do. But there was that critical time where I had to make a choice and walk away from family traditions and family culture, because our faith was more than just going to church on Sunday. It really was a cultural experience. So I had to walk away from that and be prepared to choose my own path and then make it on my own.
Hmm. So having grown up in a rural area and then moving on must have been a big shift for you.
It really was, but it was exciting at every step of the way. The idea of getting up in the morning and not having to head for the barn to throw hay bales, it was pretty interesting. I mean, when I was a little kid, I thought that every little boy had to do that. You know, we tend to think that everybody lives the life that we're living when we're little. So it was really interesting as I started to discover that some kids didn't do that. Some kids just got up and pulled on their blue jeans and boots and headed for school. So as I explored new things, and then Joanna and I got married when we were quite young, and both kind of escaping our homes, but we hung on to each other and experimented, learned along the way, have had an incredible journey together, and we continue experimenting with new things.
Mm-hmm.
I have never been content with sameness. If things become predictable, they become very boring to me very quickly. So I'm always looking for ways to change, to try new things, even to this day. So I've never at any period of time had a long season in my life that really looked the same. We've moved a lot, lived different places, different cultures and climates. And in terms of what I've done, I mean, most of what I've known for at this point has happened in the last 8 to 10 years. I mean, prior to that, I did a lot of different things. But then kind of found that sweet spot where I found people responding well to things that I wrote and spoke. And so that opened up some new opportunities that I've leveraged pretty dramatically in the last few years. But even there, I mean, sometimes, here's an example, Ken. I do a podcast that is one of the most powerful components of my business. Podcast listeners, there's an intimacy and connection that goes beyond what there is if people read my books or blogs or newsletters. So it really is a powerful piece of what I'm doing. I used to be on traditional landline radio until I discovered the power of podcasting and the extended reach of podcasting beyond what radio has. That being said, it is at this point a very significant part of what I'm doing. However, if new technology comes along that gives me, again, you know, 10, 20 times the power of what I'm doing in my podcast now as going to podcast from radio did, I'll switch. I'm not married. I'm not stuck to anything that I'm doing. It's just that as we explore the opportunities, this seems to make sense right now. But that's one of the exciting things about the kind of times we live in right now. Technology, communications, all those things are changing so rapidly that our opportunities change daily. You know, Peter Drucker used to say, if you're doing the same thing today you were doing 1 year ago, you're probably falling behind. So the challenge is, okay, how can I take my skills and engage them in a meaningful way based on what I know today? And it's not so that I can just get comfortable and hope that I just continue doing the same thing for 30 years and get a gold watch and go into retirement. Those days are over.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a constant process of tweaking, adjusting, looking for the exciting new opportunities where we continue to do what we're doing, but do it even better.
So what exactly do you do?
I'm primarily a writer. Now, it took a long time for writing to move into the central focus of what I do business-wise. I use in my business a Venn diagram. So it's three circles that overlap. So if you can kind of visualize that, there's going to be one small area where all three circles intersect. For me, that's my writing. That's my sweet spot. That's what really extends my reach most. So I'm primarily a writer. I write blogs. I write guest blogs. Today I'm working on an article for a national magazine. I write for newspapers. Then I write, you know, my own traditional books. Have a new one coming out in just a few weeks.
What's the title?
Title of that is Wisdom Meets Passion.
Ooh.
And that one I wrote in conjunction with my 33-year-old son, who lives in Mombasa, Kenya.
Mm.
He's never done anything in a normal way in his entire life since the time he was a little baby. So it was a really exciting process, but writing about the blending of wisdom and passion and how it's not a matter of when you're young you have passion, when you're old you have wisdom, but we need both no matter where we are on the chronological line of our own life mm-hmm. journey. So I'm doing that. So I get a lot of opportunities to write and speak, and then because of the things that I write, you know, the speaking and personal coaching opportunities kind of coattail on those. But writing is my first love.
So the three things in your diagram are writing, coaching, and speaking?
Well, as those three circles overlap, it creates actually seven different areas. So there's seven distinct areas of income generation that we have in our business. So speaking and coaching, yeah, speaking, coaching, writing are some of those. But then we have, you know, product development, and we have affiliate relationships. We have coaching programs where we endorse other coaches and give referral fees back from what they do. So there's seven different areas. Now, the interesting thing in terms of, you know, people who want to have their own business is, as I describe what I'm doing, we have a pretty robust business in terms of size and the daily activities that go on. But I have no employees. I did not build a traditional business where I show up and there's 30 employees waiting to meet me and we have staff meetings, map out what we're going to do. Everybody whose work complements my own, and there are a lot of people whose skills do, in fact, do that, but they're all independent contractors, virtual assistants, consultants, entrepreneurs in their own right. Those kind of terms would describe what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is because that model fits me. That's not a cookie-cutter plan for everyone, but it fits me perfectly. I'm not a good people manager. I'm very impatient and results-oriented, so I want to just move through quickly to results. Thus, the people that I have connected with my business get paid for results, not time. We don't look at time as a factor that has anything to do with compensation. It's simply results produced. And that's created a real clean, efficient model for me, again, that fits me well.
Mm-hmm.
I work out of a barn on the backside of our property, just outside of Franklin, Tennessee. We're in 9 acres. So there was an old barn on the backside, and we refurbished it and gave it new life. And it's just a delightful place to work. We have an area that is large enough. We have a lot of live events here. So we bring people in and teach them about writing, how to turn their writing into significant income, and how to build a coaching practice, and other things that happen. We have art classes back here. Then we also have guest quarters here and then my office. But 99% of the time, there's no one in this building but me. I'm the only one here, so this is where I write and think, do my podcast, do interviews like this. So that all happens back here. But again, it's a very unusual kind of business. There's no place for people to come, you know, to shop. And it's all done, our presence is all done online.
What's the best thing about your job?
What I just described.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that I walk across our backyard in the morning, come across a wood chip trail that we've cut through the woods, and I don't have to worry about traffic lights. I don't have to worry about, you know, unexpected delays. Nothing at all. I don't have the frustrations of waiting at red lights. I just walk across the trail. I see the squirrels. This morning there were three deer standing there watching me as I came across. And I love the opportunity to work in that kind of environment. It's one of those things. There's an old James Michener quote that talks about, if we blend work and play properly, people won't be able to tell which we're doing. That's really the way I want to live my life.
Mm-hmm.
I want to live my life so that somebody following me around can't tell if I'm working or playing.
Let me turn the question around. What's the worst thing about your job?
The worst thing about my job? Boy, you know, that really stumps me. I mean, I am so enamored with all the things that are positives, I can't even bring to mind something that's a negative. I'm sure there is something, but I frankly I can't really even think of something that's a negative.
Well, what type of person would be good at your job?
We do a lot of work with personality styles. So, and we use the DISC terminology. So, you know, dominance, influencing, steadiness, compliance. I am extremely high on D, dominance, and C, compliance, the two end ones. Those are both very results-oriented. The other two, I and S, are very people and relationship-oriented. That's not me. So to have the kind of, for some people, what I just described as my lifestyle would be very isolated. You know, people would need more social connection and interaction with people. So it requires somebody to enjoy what I just described, who's very comfortable with solitude, who's energized, you know, with solitude, being alone. That's not everybody. So, and this is not a cookie-cutter plan, but it's something that fits me well.
Mm-hmm. But if I'm convinced now I want to have a life like yours, how would one get a job like yours?
It doesn't happen overnight, but with today's technology, it can actually take place pretty quickly. The quickest thing that I would recommend for somebody to get started would be to start a blog today. So to identify, you know, what is your area of expertise? I mean, this is not just about being a wordsmith, about just crafting words on a paper. No, it's about having a message that you can't contain. So what is the message that you have that's unique that you want to share with the world? That's the first starting point to create that kind of a focus. It really comes from looking at three areas in our lives. You know, what do you have the ability to do? What are your personality tendencies? What are your values, dreams, and passions? But from those, you ought to see some clear patterns emerge to help you create a focus. Once you understand what that focus is, and it can be landscaping or working with pets or training your children or whatever it happens to be. Mine is, you know, in giving people encouragement and hope that they really can go to higher levels of success. Once you discover that focus, though, then having a blog is the easiest way to get in the game. It's the easiest way to test your material and see if people do really, in fact, respond to that. If they do, then you can start to be recognized as an expert. You can comment on other blogs that are similar in content to your own. You start to build a name for yourself. You've got to build an audience. One of the biggest things that I deal with in terms of people who want to, do what I do is they see that I write, and so they just want to write. They want to write, and then they just want to, you know, send that manuscript off to a publisher and then go put a picnic or put a lawn chair by the mailbox and wait on those royalty checks to show up. That doesn't happen. Those days are over. If they ever were here, they certainly don't exist today. Authors have to create their own platform. So we're very active in engaging people through my blogs, newsletters, podcasts, live events that we do, with a social networking site that's 48days.net, where people share ideas, encourage each other. I just kind of give oversight to that. So those are ways that you build an audience. If you build an audience, then you can write to your heart's content.
If there is such a thing, what's a typical day like for you?
Typical day is I get up, I'm a morning guy, so I'm usually up by 5:30 or 6. I spend 30 minutes just in quiet meditation, reading something that's positive, uplifting, wholesome. Never turn on the news, never grab a newspaper. That is not what I want to start my day with. So I start with positive kind of input. Then I jump on the treadmill. Now, when I'm on the treadmill, and I'm on there for a full hour, it's the kind of exercise that I enjoy. There's a built-in TV on my treadmill. But again, that is not what I put on. I listen then to podcasts while I'm on there. There's all kinds of positive information circulating out there. It allows me to stay abreast of newest trends that are happening, you know, new ideas, things that are working for people, and just continued input of positive information. Then by about 8 o'clock, my wife is usually up. She's not an early riser. So at 8 o'clock, then we meet and we have a cup of tea and a morning muffin. That's what we have every morning, and we discuss, you know, what we're doing, events of the days, news we've heard from the kids, and those kind of things, just kind of recap what we're going to do. So I'm usually back in my office and back here at the barn on our property by about 9 o'clock. I don't schedule anything before 9, even in terms of like interviews and things. So usually 9 o'clock is when my day kind of officially starts. But I may have the entire morning then blocked out to work on an article or to work on a manuscript where I've got a contract with a publisher. So I have big blocks of time in my schedule that are dedicated to the things that I really consider important. Now, that being said, I may have then that I'm going to spend from 9 o'clock to 12 o'clock working on a manuscript. So somebody calls, as inevitably happens, "Golly, Dan, we want you to serve on this committee. You know, we're going to have a meeting 10 o'clock Thursday morning." I can very comfortably look at my schedule and say, "I'm sorry, I already have a commitment." See, a lot of people wouldn't see it that way. They'd see it, unless it's a connection with another person, then it's totally flexible. But if you do that, then you crowd out the thing that you are saying is most important. So I don't do that. I am very intentional about the use of my time.
Mm-hmm. You got to be committed to your work, too.
That's right. So I say no to, you know, 80% of the things that I'm confronted with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, lunch appointments, you know, dinner engagements, committee, serving on boards, and so on. You know, I'm very strategic about the things like that I do, because then people, you know, ask me, you know, how do I turn out the quantity of things that I do? My goal in 2011 was to create one new product a month. Well, people consider that to be really aggressive. Well, I did that up until November. Now, I created 10 new products. It was right on schedule. But then it was the 1st of November when I negotiated the contract to have a manuscript to my publisher by February 1st. That's a short time frame for a manuscript. But as with all my writing, I'm not starting with a clean slate. I have a lot of content from which to draw. So I switched my efforts. So I ended up with 10 rather than 12 new products. But, you know, and this has a lot to do with how we set goals. People think, well, if you set a goal to have 12 and then you only have 10, you failed. Well, I guess you could say that. But I'm not crying a whole lot about that, because I don't know too many other people that created 10 new products. And those tend to be 60 to 70 page manifesto just on new topics. You know, I had one that's really been a hot potato for us, Learn and Grow Rich. How to get an education that really matters, and it may not involve sitting in a classroom somewhere, but how to get an education that's going to really enrich you and make you a candidate for extraordinary kind of success. Just released one on 1 + 1 = 3, how to create your own mastermind group. That's been a powerful part of my own life, and we get a lot of requests about that because I reference my own mastermind group in my podcast a lot. Mm. So people ask about that. So I seed these kind of topics in the free formats that I do, and then I create products, and then people stand in line and say, you know, I want that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I create a lot of, you know, short products. We do audio things, the drop of a hat, and just keep creating content because I have been very intentional about creating an audience. So we have a pretty, you know, pretty big audience. And they're ready to participate in, you know, anything that we provide for them.
Mm-hmm. You've done a lot of national media, too.
I have, yeah.
Do you like being famous?
You know, it tickles me when you put it in those terms because I still see myself as a little farm kid from Ohio. You know, not that I'm going to hang my head in undue modesty, but I'd never want to get to the point where I'm seen as hard to get to or too big to talk to. And it grieves me sometimes when I hear somebody say, you know, oh, you know, a year ago I saw you guys sitting at a restaurant and we were there, but I just didn't have the guts to come over and talk to you. I'm like, my gosh, come talk to us. We're real people. Joanne and I do travel a lot, and it is... interesting at this point how we can be pretty much anywhere in the world and somebody will walk up and say, you know, aren't you Dan Miller? Many times they recognize not even my face but my voice.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have so much content out there that has my voice connected with it.
Yeah.
But I, for whatever it's worth, I mean, I certainly enjoy the benefits of having things that have done well in the marketplace. No question about that. I mean, we're able to do things that, you know, most people only dream of doing. You know, we travel at will, and we're able to help causes and people in ways that we would have never dreamed possible a few years ago. So with being famous, you know, comes an obligation to, I think, continue, you know, being available. It does, you know, concern me when I see people who all of a sudden are famous and then they are, you know, they've got bodyguards around them and nobody can talk to them anymore because they're above that. I'm thinking, really? Come on.
Yeah. Dan, everybody has to give themselves motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
My reading is without question my biggest continued motivator. I am drawn to books like a moth to light. There's never an end of new material out there. There's rarely a day that goes by that UPS doesn't stop at my door with my daily shipment from Amazon. I mean, there's just so many things out there that I want to consume. Those are the things that inspire me. But I get a lot of magazines as well. I just got the newest edition of Success Magazine. I mean, it's just astounding the things you can add, the glimpses into people's lives in there that are inspiring, and it's positive information. It's not some sleazy, you know, let's look at how this person screwed up. It's how did this person succeed? What are they doing now? So there's that. That Success Magazine always has an audio CD in it, so you can count on it the next morning on the treadmill. That's what I'm going to be listening to is that. But other magazines, even like Ode, just magazines that are attempting to make the world a better place. And certainly things like Inc. and Wired and Fast Company and all those. I mean, I read those voraciously. So it's my reading that inspires me. But I also seek out people who are high achievers. I mean, one of the real characteristics of extraordinarily successful people is that they're spending time with people who are already performing at the level at which they want to perform. So I've always sought out high achievers, and just attempted to spend time with them. Not in some elitist kind of way, I shook hands with Brad Paisley, but, can I take you to lunch? I want to pick your brain, get your advice and opinion on this. What do you think about this? And I've had a wealth of information and education from asking people who are high achievers those kind of questions.
Mm-hmm. When you have to soothe yourself, how do you calm yourself down?
By reading again. I often, though, living on 9 acres is not an accident. I still have enough of the farm kid in me that I love getting outside. So a lot of times I'll take a mental break by getting outside. So I'll walk around the nature trail that goes back through the woods in our property, or I'll jump on my little John Deere tractor and move some mulch or put some stones in place in a new landscaping area that we've got going up. I'm looking out the window here. Got a guy out here working right now who just planted 75 hostas. I've mentioned in some of my live events and on my podcast that this is the year I'm going to really become a hosta expert. They're a beautiful leafy plant, and there's so many interesting varieties of them. They're very hardy. They grow like crazy here in Tennessee. So I mentioned that. So it opened kind of Pandora's box in terms of people sending me hostas. I had a gentleman who is in charge of the landscaping at University of Mississippi, and that campus last year was chosen number one campus in the country in terms of landscaping appeal. But he sent me some hostas, and I got a gentleman up in Ohio that just sent me some who is really connected with some international varieties that are hard to find in the States. So I've got things like that, and those are my unwinding things. It's not that I get highly stressed and judge just I'm going to blow a gasket, but in terms of even creativity, if I'm working on an article and I reach kind of an impasse or I'm having difficulty with the transition, I don't just sit there and look at the screen. I get up and go do something else. I'll get outside, switch gears, go to a different part of my brain, and tap into that term. It's called the adjacent possible, where if you are working on something too closely, you may not be able to see it, and you step just aside, and all of a sudden, new possibilities come up as a result of that new perspective. So I do that a lot. I utilize those kind of breaks as part of stimulating creativity. Grab my 4-year-old granddaughter, who's an incredible inspiration to me, and say, hey, let's go to lunch together. And so we do that. That gives me new insight.
4-year-olds are like that.
my granddaughter comes down here with her mother, who works, she's part of our 48 Days team, her mother is, my daughter. But she brings Clara, 4 years old, down here to the art class. Now, initially, it was just to kind of be a convenient babysitter and give daddy a break, blah, blah, blah. So she was down here. But instead of just playing out here in the little fish pond outside my office, she very quickly just assimilated herself into the art classes. So she has her own canvas and her boards and her paints. So she paints. Now, here's what's really interesting in terms of fresh perspective. We have in here 50-year-old women. And they paint, and they stand back and say, oh, wow, the color really isn't right on that tree. And over here, it's kind of lopsided. It's not the same on the left and the right. This little path coming down through, it's hard to tell if that's a road or if it's a stream. What does Clara do, 4 years old? She draws something. She stands back and says, oh, my gosh, that is beautiful. I'm really good. And I wonder when we lose that. And these ladies are wondering that. When do we lose the ability to think that what we do has value, to think that we're really good? So those kind of things provide ongoing content for me as an author in the kind of writing that I do. 48 Days to the Work You Love and Passion, or Wisdom Meets Passion, those kind of things. So those kind of real-life experiences always provide me new fodder for the writing when I come back to it.
Dan, is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
Yes. about 22 years ago. I am an entrepreneur from the top of my head to the tip of my toes. Make no apologies for that. I love the thrill of victory, but you know what the other part of that cliche is, the agony of defeat. I had built businesses. I'd been pretty successful in doing that, so I had auto accessory businesses and different things at a health and fitness center, and then some things changed in the banking world. It caused a convergence of things that just put me in a really untenable situation. I ended up selling that health and fitness center at public auction and ended up owing about $430,000. A big chunk of that to the IRS and the rest to vendors. Yeah, that was a challenging event, no question about it. And having had things come fairly easily up to that point, you know, well, for one thing, my first response was, you know, well, no big deal. You know, I'll clean this mess up a couple years. I'll be back on top. Well, it took longer than that. Things compounded rather than just started being alleviated at that point. It compounded. So it took much longer than what I anticipated. And I had advice and good legal advice to just file bankruptcy and walk away from it. Of course, IRS liens are not bankruptable anyway, so I would have still had that. But I said, you know, I can't do that. You know, I was raised Mennonite. And that tradition, you know, if your word isn't any good, you might as well dig a hole and push me in.
Mm-hmm.
I said, these are people I promised to. I mean, these were agreements, even if they weren't legal, contractual, whatever, they were agreements that I need to honor. So it took me much more time than what I anticipated. But my life didn't stop at that point. And it's funny now, our children were small. But in looking back at that, our children don't even remember going through a tough time because our relationships didn't change. Yeah, we stopped going to Sanibel Island for vacation. So we may, you know, drive through Taco Bell, get some burritos, and go to the local park. They didn't understand that anything had changed because the joy in our home didn't change. The commitment to each other in terms of positive relationships didn't change. But that was a real pivotal event for me.
Mm-hmm.
It taught me to be much more careful and not just so haphazard as I had been. But it also opened my eyes to some ways to create businesses that I would have never seen otherwise. Previous to that, I had always assumed that if you want a bigger business, you lease a bigger building, hire more employees, and buy more inventory. That experience forced me to look at all the possibilities, and I began to see that I could build a business that had no ceiling on it at all, in a way that I didn't have any buildings, no employees, none of the physical constraints of a traditional bricks and mortar business. And I thought, you've got to be kidding me. Had things continued as they would, I would have just continued on the path that I was in. So it's one of those, again, it's easy to say in retrospect, well, you know, I value the experience or it's the best thing that happened to me. I don't give just light lip service to that. It was a very painful experience in a lot of ways. But it really did help open me up to what I'm doing today that otherwise I probably would have missed.
Is there an idea or a principle that has helped you through your challenges?
Well, if there's just an easy kind of principle, it's the glass is half full. I'm one of those kind of guys. I always see the glass is half full. You know, if you fill my mailbox with horse manure, I'm going to be looking around for a pony. It's just part and parcel of who I am. And I think that innate optimism has served me extremely well. I see other people who go through one negative experience and they just get stuck at the bottom of the ditch. I'm thinking, wow, you know, don't let that shape your life. That was one experience. Get up and go on. So I know that has served me well, and it's probably as much a personality trait as it is just a principle. But if there is one, it's that ability to see the glass as half full.
If you were giving a commencement address for high school or college, giving your best advice, what would you say?
I spoke to a group of college students yesterday, And I was amazed once again by their tendency to get the cart before the horse. They're looking for where are the best opportunities, who's hiring, what are the hottest business trends, career opportunities out here. And it really is a recipe for short-term success and long-term frustration and disaster. So my encouragement, even at the college level, is look inward first. 85% of the confidence that we can have about proper direction in our career or business comes from looking inward first. So figure out how God has uniquely wired you. That's going to give you the confidence to then shape something that fits that. Embrace what you know about yourself. Too many people are trying to make themselves something they're not. The biggest regret that people, there's a recent study that came out talking to people who knew they were approaching death. The biggest regret that people have knowing they're approaching death is I didn't have the courage to live a life authentic to myself. Spent too much time trying to please others, live out the expectations of others. So this is not about being narcissistic or egotistical or self-centered. It's about being authentic. So my encouragement to people, no matter where they are, again, on this path, is look inward first. Be comfortable with that. Be confident you can shape amazing opportunities no matter what it is you find out about yourself. So if you're more introverted and shy, you can find opportunities that embrace that and allow you to have success that other people will not. If you're outgoing and gregarious and social, fantastic. Let's make sure that we embrace that so you don't end up feeling like you're, you know, the Lone Ranger out here.
My last question has helped me get better at this process. Is there a question I didn't ask but should have, or something you wanted to say but haven't?
Well, you've covered a lot of territory. I mean, I've had a very interesting and blessed life experience. Again, that not being that this is some linear path where I had a silver spoon in my mouth and it's always just been upward success. I mean, life is a journey. And what I tell people, maybe this would be a good kind of wrap up. A lot of people identify success by, you know, having a big house and having two gold Mercedes in the driveway, whatever. It may mean something totally different to the next person. We see a lot of people, especially in the Gen X and Y, who are, in essence, inverting Maslow's old hierarchy of needs. Now, in that original hierarchy of needs, we see at the bottom, you know, basic needs. So if you're hungry or thirsty or don't know where you're going to sleep tonight, that has preeminence. And until you meet that need, you'll never be concerned about self-esteem or belonging and move up, you know, to self-actualization. Well, you know what? We see kids today who go right to the top. They want to make the world a better place. They want to do something noble. They want to serve humanity. They want to make a difference. And those kind of things before they even have a place to sleep, before they have a car. I mean, I've got a son who lives in Mombasa, Kenya. He doesn't have a house. He doesn't have a car. His possessions you could put in a suitcase, and he thinks he's living a dream life. He has none of the things that we traditionally have thought, in America at least, that you have to have for success. He considers his life to be an absolute dream life with where he is now. So, you know, with that, what I tell people, success is not a destination, it's a direction. We don't have to wait to be successful. This is not some, you know, I can't be successful until I get my college degree, you know, until I make my first $1 million. No, you can be successful today if you identify a positive direction and start on that path.
I want to thank Dan Miller for joining me today. Thanks, Dan. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. My pleasure. I hope that we can bring your listeners some hope and encouragement, which is what I'm a messenger of.
If you'd like to leave a comment, ask a question, or get more info, go to whatsitlike.info.